Thank you so much for joining us. I'm here with Dr. Ellen Ofsen, who's a board-certified internist and addiction specialist who's had a remarkable career in addiction patient service delivery, as well as leading the way in gender-specific and really a whole understanding of separating genders in evaluation and treatment. And we'll spend some time talking a little bit about that and your career and how that might inform some of our discussions about pain and addiction. Okay. So you've had a big time and long-term career and worked in a lot of settings, and now you're the medical director at Lakeview Health, but run the women's program. What would a women's program look like for someone who hasn't been at Harvard or McLean Hospital, or I don't even know if there are any other programs other than that?
Well, this is the first gender-responsive treatment program that I've worked in, and when I was recruited here and was told that I was going to be put in the Women's Center, I wasn't real happy about it because my experience in other places had been that they were not gender-responsive, the men and women were not separated, and the women tended to be more disruptive. My experience at the Rose at Lakeview, which is the women's program, is that it is totally different. The women are much more engaged in treatment. They are much more focused on their issues, and they seem to get better quicker.
So there's been some studies from NIDA about the value of separating the genders and how it just makes it easier to focus on addiction, but it must also make it get easier to talk about sex or trauma.
Absolutely. And our trauma program, again, is gender responsive. Our women are together for their trauma groups, totally separate from the men. And I think that it allows them to, number one, identify that they're not alone, that there are other women that have been victimized like they have. And I think it leads to a more open discussion and resolution of the problem.
So for people who work in addiction evaluation and treatment, even people who are in primary care, it's not a question that we routinely ask, like, have you ever had physical, sexual, or emotional trauma? And in both addiction and in pain evaluation, it's coming up and up and up as a key issue to consider.
It's essential.
It's essential. Is it common? I mean, if you were to take, how big is a program like your program? How many beds would it be? In the 20 patients or something?
We normally have somewhere between 30 and 40 women.
30 and 40 women.
Yes.
So let's say you had 30 women. Would what percent of them would have been sexually abused?
Most of them. I think the studies nationwide say about 70%. I think it's higher than that. At least in my experience in treating these patients.
Well, I mean, you would know. You're the go-to expert. So let's say it's more than, it may be 20.
I would say that the lack of trauma would be an exception in my population.
So if you ask someone about their alcohol or opioid use disorder and they denied everything, you'd ask them again because it's that common?
Yes. And in fact, I take an extensive trauma history when I'm doing the new patient evaluation, and the way I ask is who abused you? Not were you abused, but who abused you? Because I presume that they were abused.
It's hard to imagine. So how long does that take to do an event? Like, could a doctor in practice ask enough questions to know whether somebody should be in specialized treatment?
Yeah, and I think that the key is I try not to re-traumatize the patient when I'm doing that initial evaluation, because I know that they're going to be assessed some more and they're going to be put in trauma group. You know, as I say, I'm not going to open Pandora's box when I start out. What I want to do is to get basic information. And I say, you don't even need to tell me the details. Mm-hmm. Tell me how old you were,
Mm-hmm.
Who was the perpetrator just by age or by relationship? And then, I subsequently will go into the symptoms of PTSD to see if they have, continued to have symptoms from that.
So they make diagnosis, but that you can do without going into the details.
Right, because it re-traumatizes them, especially when they're first getting sober.
Mm-hmm. So we often hear about the sex for drugs or, kind of that experience of someone who's an addict and needs and wants drugs for their continued use and trades. But you're talking about something that predates that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you then had the early sexual trauma, do you then also see the sex for drugs, or that doesn't happen anymore?
I think we call that trauma repetition.
Huh.
And almost every patient I've ever seen who's involved in any kind of sex trade was sexually abused as a child.
And you've had extensive experience, including running the most famous sexual compulsivity program.
Absolutely.
In the United States. So that's, okay, so let's just put on a different hat and talk about your life and understanding of both internal medicine and pain. Mm-hmm. So how does the gender play into pain and pain perception, and then maybe opioid misuse?
Well, I think that women present with pain with underlying depression, anxiety, and PTSD. I think it magnifies the pain. I think that they may not even be aware of the trauma that underlies it, but their path to becoming addicted to opioids tends to be one where they have presented to a physician for pain and have been given prescriptions, and women are given a lot more prescription opioids than men for the diagnosis of pain. And it's interesting because women become addicted very quickly to opioids if they're predisposed to the disease. And one of the studies I looked at, they can become addicted within a week of being prescribed opioids, but they're often prescribed more and more highly potent opioids than men are. So it just fans the flames.
Hmm.
But there's always an emotional component to it.
So, when you think about gender and pain and addiction, and people ignore taking sexual history, we don't even get many of our trainees to take a complete sexual history from the point of view of infectious disease.
Right.
You must see a lot of medical as well as psychiatric comorbidity.
Oh, absolutely. Sexually transmitted diseases, we don't see as much HIV as we see hepatitis C, but it's quite frequent in this population.
So from a treatment point of view, when you're in a environment where you have gender responsive treatment and trauma treatment that's almost mandatory, I guess, or that is your program.
It's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, they have to have that. What else do they have?
Well, they have this pain recovery program. Mm-hmm. There's a professionals program. We also have physical therapy.
That's a good thing.
Which is very, very important. We also have a wellness center that has personal trainers.
Hmm.
So for the people who don't have significant pain, they still get to benefit from the wellness center and the personal trainers. It's very therapeutic.
So when you hear about relapse in treatment and some of the problems in treatment outcomes, do you think one of the reasons is the lack of attention to the underlying causes like sexual, physical, and emotional trauma?
Oh, I know it is. I mean, if you look at, one of the things that I've heard is for every symptom of PTSD that goes unaddressed in treatment, the risk of relapse goes up.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I don't understand why that wouldn't be more normative. Like, why would you... I was trying to think back into Betty Ford time,
mm-hmm.
and I spent a lot of time there and
right.
was on the foundation board for a while, and they had the absolute separation of genders, except for a common lecture once a week, which the women were on one side of the auditorium, the men on the other. And but that kind of, and she had meditation studio, and she had a lot of approach for trauma, and that kind of approach just hasn't really taken off, even though NIDA sponsored research on it, and there's a great group at McLean Hospital that's worked on that. What do you think is the reason that gender responsive treatment?
I think it's more labor intensive to do it that way, because you have to provide equal services in two different centers. I think it's mainly cost driven.
Mm-hmm. Is there a case that might come to mind of somebody who would have a pain syndrome, and which was particularly difficult, and that you felt like you got to the bottom of?
Well, I told you earlier today about a 55-year-old female that I currently have in treatment. She's been in treatment about 2 weeks with an 18-year history of opioid use disorder. And she has rheumatoid arthritis, so she has legitimate pain. She was referred to a pain physician fairly early on after her diagnosis. And she also has antecedent trauma, they all do. But here she is 2 weeks out and she has no pain, absolutely none. Her mood's stable. She's on some psychotropic medication, but not a lot. And it's miraculous to see these people who go from, I can't live without my opioids, to being, how did I ever live this opiate use disorder life?
Well, that must be gratifying to you as a doctor, too.
It's great.
I mean, you do see a lot of benefit. It's just nice for the patients to be able to have a doctor, addiction medicine internist, who's got so much important experience and so much to add.
Well, thank you.
So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and it's always a pleasure to see Dr. Ellen Ofson and to hear about her work and contributions to the field and the importance of gender in pain evaluation and addiction evaluation and treatment.